And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It's all about baseball on today's program as another season of Major League Baseball gets underway. Part one is with best-selling author Keith O'Brien talking about his latest book called Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. You don't need to be a baseball fan to probably recognize the name Pete Rose, who compiled more hits than anybody else in the history of professional baseball, but whose career tragically disintegrated due to his gambling addiction. Keith O'Brien does an amazing job of telling this story in his brand new book published by Pantheon. Keith O'Brien, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks so much for having me.
You have done such a brilliant job of bringing this extraordinary figure of Pete Rose vividly to life. At one point, very early in the book, you describe Pete Rose as the most ordinary, extraordinary athlete in the history of American sports. Explain what you mean by that intriguing turn of phrase.
Well, that is how I think about Pete Rose. You know, he, frankly, you know, was ordinary in many ways. He had ordinary talents. He had ordinary athleticism for the entirety of his childhood. And I mean, all the way through high school, he was never the best baseball player on his own team. And you know, despite all these things, you know, he gets a chance to play minor league baseball. And he gets that chance because he has, you know, one torrid stretch in the spring of 1960 in essentially a semi-pro league in Dayton, Ohio. And he's got a connection. His uncle Buddy is friends with the farm director of the Cincinnati Reds. So almost as a favor, you know, he gets an offer to go to Geneva, New York to play for the Geneva Redlegs. And this is the lowest of the low of minor league baseball. It's a rung of baseball that's so low it doesn't even exist anymore. And you know, he manages to do well there and move his way up. And all of these things just seem incredibly unlikely. In fact, you know, as I went back and looked at it, I think, frankly, it's almost miraculous that Pete Rose ever became Pete Rose.
Mm. And one thing I learned, among many things I learned from your book, is that this famous nickname he was given of Charlie Hustle was not meant as a compliment. It was attached to him by a couple of his rivals who were, in a sense, making fun of that sort of scrappy side of him. But it's a perfect nickname, isn't it?
It's a great nickname. Really becomes his persona. You know, Charlie Hustle is the kind of guy who will sprint down to first base on a walk, the kind of guy who will get into a fight at second base trying to break up a double play, the kind of guy who will, you know, run into a catcher at home plate and break his shoulder in a meaningless exhibition game. That's who Charlie Hustle is. And it is, I think, endlessly interesting that the nickname is bestowed upon him almost as sarcasm. You know, Mickey Mantle and Whitey Ford are watching him play in a spring training game in 1963, and they find it absurd how hard he is playing. But, you know, it would be easy, you know, say, coming from Mickey Mantle or Whitey Ford to make fun of Pete Rose. I mean, those guys were like the golden gods of baseball, you know, imbued with so much talent. And Pete Rose knew that he had to play hard. He had to work hard in order to make it.
Right. I mean, to be in this world at all, let alone to succeed. One of the things I think I most deeply appreciate about this book is that someone else with other priorities would have probably focused nearly all of his time and attention on the downfall of Pete Rose, the disintegration of his baseball career. And you don't do that. I mean, we are told that story in almost breathtaking detail, but you are just as careful to tell us the story about his glory days. I'm reminded of a TV interview with figure skater Tanya Harding that, for once, focused on her first triple axel and asking about that in great detail. And as she's recounting it, she stops and starts to cry at one point and said, "I'm sorry, nobody ever asks me about this anymore. I mean, of course, her whole life was swallowed up in her scandal. And in some ways, you know, Pete Rose is maybe to some extent a similar sort of story. And you seem to be so anxious for us not to just think about the disaster that engulfed Pete Rose and brought his career down in flames, but you want us to also remember his extraordinary glory as a player before all the rest of that happened.
I'm so glad you mentioned it. I agree with that 100%. You know, Pete Rose in some ways has lived for so long and made so many mistakes off the field that we have forgotten who he once was or who he really is. And again, whether you like him or not, whether you defend him or not, Pete Rose was an American icon. He was one of our greatest icons in the second half of the 20th century. And my premise from the start of this project was that we only care about someone's fall, about someone's mistakes, about someone's foibles or implosion in the case of Pete Rose, because we ever cared about them in the first place, you know? And so I wanted to, you know, essentially in this narrative, take us back to this time and place when Pete Rose wasn't the caricature of an old gambler that we know today. He was young and he had dreams, and America saw in him, you know, its own dream and its own story. Sure. And so, you know, my goal with the narrative was to bring him essentially to the mountaintop, because Pete Rose will get to the mountaintop of American life.
Right.
And give folks the view from that mountaintop, because the view was amazing. And then we can watch him tumble and fall off that mountain, because he will, in large part because of his own decisions, his own choices, and his own addiction.
Right. Speaking of mountaintops, you choose to begin the book, your introduction, in September 1985. Briefly explain why this is such a critical moment in his life and career, and why you chose to, in effect, begin your book there.
Only two men in the history of baseball have ever amassed 4,000 total hits. Ty Cobb, and then in 1984, he was joined by Pete Rose. In the history of baseball, two guys have gotten to 4,000. And in September 1985, Pete Rose is on the cusp of passing Ty Cobb and claiming the all-time hit record. And, you know, baseball has waned in recent decades as a cultural touchstone, but it was so critical to American culture in 1985. And, you know, this moment in Cincinnati on this night when Pete will pass Ty Cobb is carried live on national television. Networks break into regularly scheduled programming to tell viewers that Pete Rose has just passed Ty Cobb. And if you were alive and watching, you know exactly where you were that night. And 50,000 people were at Riverfront Stadium, where the game took place, in Cincinnati. And when he, you know, safely rounds first and comes back to the bag with a clean single to left center field, the crowd at Riverfront showers him with a standing ovation that will last for 7 minutes. And you know, that's notable, of course. All of those things are notable. But the most notable thing to me is this: you know, as the crowd continues to cheer unabated, you know, Pete Rose, you know, finally can't take it anymore. He becomes emotional. He breaks down and he cries. And it is significant to me because it was the first time anyone had ever seen him do that. And by the way, it was the last time. We haven't seen that kind of emotion from him, Pete Rose, since 1985.
Wow. We're speaking with Keith O'Brien about his brand new book, amazing book, Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball. Your book is not only about Pete Rose, but about the game of baseball. And you say in the introduction to the book that the world and the world of Major League Baseball had changed dramatically in the quarter century that Pete Rose had played professional baseball. That is kind of leading up to the start of the fall. What would be a couple of the most significant changes that occurred in baseball during his career, What I'm really interested in is the changes that really matter in this particular story. That is, how had baseball changed in a way that, in a sense, helped contribute to Pete Rose's self-destruction?
Well, it changed in a couple of important ways. And the first is all about money. You know, in 1963, when Pete is a rookie, almost every ball player had to have some kind of off-season job. Guys could not live on a baseball salary. The free agency that comes in the 1970s, which I believe is deserved by players, nevertheless fundamentally alters the game in ways we're still wrestling with today. You know, fans begin to begrudge the fact that players are so highly paid. The owners are even wealthier. And by 1989, when Pete Rose gets in trouble for gambling, and when the rumors of his gambling on baseball first reach the front office of Major League Baseball in New York, the league has just signed its very first billion-dollar television contract. And Peter Uberoff, the outgoing commissioner at the time, is very proud of it. He holds a press conference in New York, and he tells everybody that's billion with a B. And the money in the game and the corporatization of baseball really fundamentally changes it. Baseball had once been not just a sport where the players didn't make that much money. They were just also a little unpolished, a little rough around the edges. In the 1960s and 70s, many of our beloved stars said and did things that they could never get away with today. In this new world that was coming, Pete Rose is still behaving the same way he always had. He still believes he can do anything, but he can't. And for the misdeeds now, he's going to pay a terrible price.
One of the choices you make, and it is such a good choice, and it's one of the most important aspects of the book and fascinating aspects of the book, is that you talk not only about Pete Rose himself, but about some of the people who were in his close orbit, who assisted him in all kinds of ways. And in effect, in some cases, were sort of accessories to the crime, not sort of. and the story of how they were kind of drawn into his orbit, what attracted them to Pete Rose, and then some of the difficult choices they ultimately had to make, that's an especially interesting facet of all this. We don't have a lot of time, I'm afraid, but maybe you could just choose a couple of the most critical figures and just talk about what was kind of most interesting or compelling about them as you told this story.
Yeah, the figure that comes to mind for me is Tommy Giosa. Tommy Giosa was one of these men in Pete's inner circle. He was one of three men that I interviewed who placed Pete Rose's bets on baseball. And, in past, works about Pete and in many newspaper and magazine articles written in the 1980s and 90s, Tommy is often described with words that I think are not just insulting, but inaccurate. They would, call him, a hangers-on or a thug or whatever. And I don't see it like that at all. Tommy, like many people, was enamored by Pete. And I will say Pete has a charisma about him. He had it then. He still has it now. And when you are, getting Pete's warmth and attention, it does make you feel something. And so Tommy is, almost trapped by Pete's gravitational pull. Even when Tommy knows he should maybe stop hanging out with Pete Rose, he should maybe leave Cincinnati, he should maybe stop doing Pete's bidding, he can't. And for these choices, Tommy Giosa, will pay an awful price. Mm. He will ultimately spend more than 2 years in federal prison, in part because Tommy refused to cooperate with investigators in 1989 when they wanted to know what Pete was doing with gamblers.
He was such a loyal friend in so many ways. It sounds like one of the chief reasons that Pete Rose got into his most serious trouble, that is when his gambling escapades expanded beyond other sports to include his own sport of professional baseball, that escalation and just the amount of gambling that he was doing, that is part of what got him in trouble. And also that as he sort of escalated, he also sort of climbed into a different level of the gambling world and in a sense was maybe dealing with less friendly characters. Briefly, can you talk about that aspect of Pete Rose's ultimate self-destruction?
Yeah, I mean, one thing I tried to do with the book was really sort of chart how Pete unraveled, and it really begins in the early 1970s when he at least by that point, if not sooner, is betting with a bookie on the west side of Cincinnati, Pete Rose's part of town, the place where Pete was born and raised. And you know, in the early parts of his gambling career, if you will, Pete was, you know, often placing his bets with friendly bookies, let's say, guys who, you know, would let him carry a debt, guys who weren't even going to rat him out, when and if they got arrested. And by the way, some of them did in the early 1970s. And they don't turn on Pete when they easily could have then. But by the 1980s, that's changed too. You know, Pete is no longer placing bets with bookies that he has known his whole life. He's placing bets with bookies who are total strangers. And some of these men, you know, have their own shady ties. You know, some of these men are on the edge of organized crime. And so, you know, again, Pete is still behaving like he had for years, and is blissfully unaware that the world has changed and that the men he's now gambling with don't really care about Pete Rose. And that's going to matter because one of these bookies will ultimately turn on Pete and he will tell Major League Baseball everything it wants to know.
Looks like it's our last question, which is Pete Rose steadfastly maintained his innocence when it came to betting on baseball for years and years and years. It's not until 2004 or 2005, I think, that he finally admits to that. You got to actually interview Pete Rose. I wonder, in your conversations, did you get a sense of what prompted him to finally make this admission that, yes, indeed, he had bet on professional baseballs and even on games involving his own team? Why did he admit that?
You know, I mean, his admission comes way too late. Why does he admit it in 2004? You know, Pete says that it was time to finally tell the truth. I think there's some ulterior motives there as well. You know, he was hoping that by finally telling the truth, that he would essentially be forgiven and maybe possibly reinstated as an eligible player. Obviously, in 2004, when Pete is now 63 years old, he's not going to be playing baseball. But by being an eligible player, he would then be eligible to be voted on for the Hall of Fame. So, you know, I think that was a key reason why. But it's too late for Pete. And the way he does it is ham-handed and sort of considered even by some of his friends to be craven. You know, he doesn't go on, say, the Oprah Winfrey show or your show and apologize and break down and cry. You know, he writes a memoir and you know, receives a very large advance from a publisher to do so. Even his attempt to apologize and to reckon with what he has done, he somehow makes it worse.
It just adds one more footnote to an ultimately tragic story, and you tell this story so amazingly well in your book, Charlie Hustle, The Rise and Fall of Pete Rose and the Last Glory Days of Baseball, published by Pantheon Books. Keith O'Brien, congratulations on a marvelous book, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show. I was so pleased to speak with you.
Oh, it was a pleasure to be here.
You're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD, FM 91.1, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and now an interview from The Morning Show archives. And with the country's attention shifting from basketball to baseball, it's a great opportunity to hear from best-selling author Tim Wendel about an absolutely wonderful and exceptionally creative book about baseball and one particular facet of the game, the fastball. His book is called High Heat, The Secret History of the Fastball and the Improbable Search for the Fastest Pitcher of All Time, published by Doc Opper. And in this book, Tim Wendel, the author of seven previous books, explores the phenomenon of the fastball in a way that we might not fully expect. I mean, there are certainly the sit-down conversations with some of the great legends of baseball, but actually Tim Wendel's exploration of this topic takes him down some unexpected paths, and that's one of the things that is most refreshing about this wonderful book. So I'm really excited to have a few minutes to speak with Tim Wendel about his book, again called High Heat, The Secret History of the Fastball and the Improbable Search for the Fastest Pitcher of All Time. And Tim Wendel, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Great to be with you, Greg.
Glad to be talking with you. Remind me, as you came to this, did you come to it as someone who's been out on the baseball diamond yourself as a player or mostly in the stands as a fan? I mean, what is your own personal connection to the game of baseball?
Well, I played, I think, like most folks, you know, Little League and such, and I found out I couldn't hit a curveball, so I had a problem with another pitch. But I was a beat writer with baseball for many years. But actually, the situation with High Heat began with a debate, you know, sitting around the stands one time. And, you know, one of the great things about baseball is you watch the game and have conversations. And the conversation became, okay, who is the fastest guy of all time? And a number of the folks that are in High Heat, say Koufax, Walter Johnson, Nolan Ryan, certainly came to the forefront right away. And I found myself kind of stuck, you know, thinking about that question and if there was a way to tease it out.
Right. And, of course, one of the things you're doing in this book is you're confronting a question that some would say is kind of a hopeless question or a meaningless question or, I mean, the kind of question that just doesn't have an answer, which doesn't mean it's a question that shouldn't be posed and wrestled with. How would you characterize the question itself of who was the fastest pitcher of all time? What kind of question is that?
Well, I think it's a question that even though you're looking, I think, in this day and age for technology, for hard data, for statistics to help you out, as you say, you kind of learn pretty quickly that, well, maybe that's not the way to go about it, in part because a lot of the measuring devices we use today, radar guns and the like, don't really work because, you know, in a sense, you know, say somebody like Walter Johnson, Bob Feller, pitched well before such technology. Now, I would argue such technology really doesn't help us that much either. You can go to a game today and, you know, have a number of different readings on the radar gun that don't really help you at all. And so I found myself after a while thinking, well, maybe we've got to look at this maybe in a little bit different context. Maybe we're so used to numbers in our society and, okay, let's just draw up the data and compare numbers. Instead, I felt, well, we certainly have some numbers, but we have to move beyond that. May look at the stories behind these fireballers and even potentially the lessons learned, because I think all these guys had a gift of a fastball. I think all of us have a gift in a sense of some certain thing we can do, and maybe that's part of living a life, is bringing that gift to the forefront. And so we can learn something from what all these fireballers went through, how they struggled, and then how a select few succeeded.
By the way, you're, of course, exactly right that we tend to entrust too much of our lives and what we think to technology and have a great fascination for and affection for and trust in numbers. But your book begins with a really fascinating exercise from many, many years ago involving the legendary pitcher Bob Feller, which would in a sense be an attempt in another era to sort of achieve the same thing. Tell our listeners the story I'm talking about.
Oh, this is one of my favorites, Greg. It concerns Bob Feller, you know, certainly one of the fastest of all time. And one of the things I think all these fireballers kind of share, besides realizing early on that they're part of a brotherhood, so to speak, they've been kind of singled out, is for the most part, almost all of them are intrigued by, okay, how fast do I throw? How do I compare with maybe the guys that preceded me, even how maybe I compare with some of the contemporaries today? So the scene is 1940. Bob Feller is in street clothes because the Cleveland Indians, of which he's the star pitcher, are going to be playing later that day in Chicago. He's taken to Lincoln Park in Chicago and told, here's a baseball. When we say go ahead, you throw the baseball and try to hit that target that's 60 feet, 6 inches away, from what the pitching mound to home plate would be. What they didn't really tell Bob too much more about was soon after he got the signal to throw the ball, even though he's throwing on a flat street, in street clothes, etc., was that a Harley-Davidson motorcycle driven by one of Chicago's finest policemen would be roaring by him on his right-hand side and hitting another target at roughly the same time. Now, all of this was filmed, and in part, it was a big experiment to try to ascertain how hard Bob Feller threw, because this was before radar guns. Again, well, we didn't have a lot of the modern-day technology. So Bob told me he always finds it amazing, number one, that he hit the target, and number two, that he didn't flinch too much as Harley Davidson roared by him at about 87 miles an hour. And from all this, from the video and then doing mathematical determinations, somehow it was determined on this day in street clothes, Bob Feller threw 104.5 miles per hour.
Hmm. Which, of course, would put him right up there, and everybody already knew already that he was among the fastest pitchers ever at that point in time, and still. But as you point out, this ultimately really isn't a story about numbers.
No, I think it's really a story about struggling with what you're given and bringing it to the utmost. And, you know, Bob Feller, a lot of people will say, well, Bob Feller didn't have to struggle that much, but actually Bob Feller was, in a sense, one of the first sports child prodigies in this country and really had to struggle under a great deal of pressure and alike. His high school graduation was covered by NBC Radio, so he was in the spotlight from an early age.
And this is someone who grew up in a small town in Iowa, right?
Town in Iowa. Some would say had an overindulgent father. The two of them built their own baseball diamond out in the cornfield in back of their house. So kind of the original Field of Dreams type of thing. And from there, they got together some teams and had games on the weekends. But everybody, the thing I find stunning in this, Greg, is that all these fireballers, I think early on, and I think any kid who's excelled in anything early, you're kind of singled out. The pressure starts to mount. Things are said, maybe even behind your back, oh, this is going to be easy because they're able to do this or that. And I think that's certainly the case with the fireballers. And in the case of some of the others, Nolan Ryan, for example, almost quit early on in his professional career. And I asked him why, and he just said, I knew I'd been given this gift that I didn't do anything to deserve, and I wasn't doing right by it. And he said, you cannot imagine the frustration that goes through you when you feel like you're not doing right by some physical talent or some ability you've been given. Hmm. And it's interesting, all the guys in high heat, dating back maybe even turn of the last century, guys like Amos Rushi, even Walter Johnson initially, they all struggled, and a fair amount of them actually failed. I think if you kind of came back to them later in life and said, hey, do you want to give back that gift of being a great fireballer? I think several of them would have said, yeah, please take it away. It's kind of like the Midas touch a little bit.
Yeah, in many respects, over and over again, this is the story of expectations and how one handles sky-high expectations off in, at a very early age, and particularly back in an era when there was no such thing as, I presume, no such thing as sports psychologists who might at least attempt to help a young athlete handle something like that.
Okay, yeah, and I think expectation's the key word, Greg, because I think we see this a lot, in fields, certainly besides baseball, but a lot of the people that excelled in this book, Sandy Koufax is a great case in point. Sandy Koufax had almost two careers in one. The first 6 years, he was a journeyman, and he was pretty much considered really bringing enough of his talent to the forefront. In about 2 weeks in spring training, roughly this time of year, he turned it around and suddenly became the Hall of Famer that everybody, knows about and such. And in a sense, a lot of it is maybe having the physical gift, but as Nolan Ryan was talking with me in High Heat, he was saying a lot of it's the mental side, too. It's like coming to grips with the expectations, the pressure, and then being able to do what you need to do in a very high-powered situation. Mm. And that kind of applies to anything that we do. And I think that's one of the things that I found encouraging as I was going through writing High Heat, as I was going, I'm learning some, not so much, these are great baseball stories, and these are names that a lot of baseball fans may not know, but these are also lessons that pretty much anybody can benefit from.
I had that exact same reaction. My other life, besides the being a radio announcer, is being a voice teacher at a local college. And in the sphere of serious music making, the matter, for instance, of expectations can really hang over somebody who is given a great gift and either makes the most of it or struggles to know what to do with it or how to do it or how to nurture that gift without compromising it somehow or pushing themselves too hard. I found a lot of the stories in your book very apropos to that arena, and I'm sure other readers will find similar surprising connections, I should think.
Well, it's funny you bring that up, because one of the things I did, Greg, was this was terribly humbling in a way, was I had my fastball tested down at Dr. James Andrews' biomechanics lab down in Alabama. And let's just say for the day, I didn't throw very hard. It was kind of a washout. And looking back on that experience later, I found that even in that short period of time when they were kind of videotaping me and they had the radar gun on me and they're analyzing my motion and all this stuff, which is, suspect at best for, of like a 50-year-old guy. But I found myself looking back at it, I'm going, even in the sense of that, I was compromising my ability. I was trying so hard to throw and hit the guy's glove who was catching me. I was trying so hard, to do things correctly that I lost, in a sense, I lost velocity. I lost some ability. And I think when you were talking about with voice or, any of these things we're talking about, say with music or sports and such, there's a very, very fine line where you're trying very, very hard, but on the other hand, you're trying to also be in control.
Right, and it might end up being the wrong kind of effort, or a kind of effort that gets in your way.
A little bit too safe, just going, okay, I want it to be perfect, or I want it to be, under control. And the thing I admire about a great many of these guys, Johnson, Koufax, Ryan, Feller, is somehow they were able to really be at the fine, fine edge of their ability. I mean, doing it as high level as you can, and yet somehow they had a semblance of control to succeed, too. That's really, really tough.
We're speaking with Tim Wendel about his book, High Heat, The Secret History of the Fastball and the Improbable Search for the Fastest Pitcher of All Time. All we have to do is open up your book and look at the table of contents, and we learn a lot about the fastball. The various chapters of your book are the windup, the pivot, the stride, the arm acceleration, the release, the follow-through, the call. And I just find that a fascinating, wonderful decision on your part to break down something which, when we just watch it happen, happens in an instant. And it looks like one thing. It doesn't look like seven or eight or nine different things. That's so helpful in and of itself, to try and break down something which happens in the blur of a, what seems like a split second.
And it's also the motion that almost all of us, you know, many of us learn as kids. And yet, here's these individuals that do this really well, and yet every phase of that, you know, from the wind up, the pivot, whatever, they know that each of that is a very integral part of the pitch. And if their pitch is going to be have velocity, if it's going to be something of substance, then each of those phases has to work. And again, this was something I found when I had my fastball tested, which was miserably slow. And in part, it was because I did a couple phases, you know, reasonably well, but then some other phases of it, I did disastrously wrong and correct. And how quickly something can be there, and it seems like it's an entity, and it's going to be worthwhile. And then one thing goes wrong, you don't do a phase as well, and suddenly it's gone. It's gone in an instant. And that's something, again, that I just couldn't believe. Yeah. It was a revelation to me because, again, I think a lot of us, when we do things, we kind of go, okay, we'll kind of, you know, play this out, and, okay, this phase I'll do okay, this one I'll kind of be all right in. No, if you want to be really, really good, all the phases have to be excellent.
And this is, of course, so about so much more than the arm. One of the very instructive moments in the book for me was when you told the story of Tommy John's ultimately the elbow surgery, which I think was named after him. Can you speak a moment about that?
Yeah, Tommy John, and some people will go, okay, what's Tommy John doing in a book about fastball, fireball, or pitchers? But in a way, Tommy, he's the one that the ligament replacement surgery in the elbow is named after. And in some ways, I think he really is symbolic of pitchers and, you know, people that really love baseball. He hurt his arm and in the 70s. And until that point, when you hurt your arm, your career was pretty much over. There's another guy in High Heat, Steve Belkowski, who's kind of the Nuke LaLoosh character, if anybody's seen Bull Durham, you know, little guy Tim Robbins played. And he hurt his arm and in a very similar fashion. And if Tommy John surgery had been around, Belkowski would have been able to continue to pitch. But Tommy was so intent on staying in the game that he went ahead with surgery that's become almost run-of-the-mill these days. High school kids, even younger, have Tommy John surgery, have ligament replacement surgery. But at that point, when Tommy John went to have it done, he had about a 1 or 2% chance that this was going to work. And he was willing to do it. And in doing so, kind of opened up the door for technology, medicine to really come into baseball. And I find it always interesting that there's a lot of guys pitching today. You know, the season's about ready to start. Guys like Joel Zamaya, et cetera, that are coming back from the surgery have no idea, you know, who is the guy who pioneered this, and yet they very much owe their career to this guy who took a chance on something that seemed out of Buck Rogers and such at that point.
One thing that is, I think, especially touching is when you explore the career and accomplishments and talent and potential of someone like a Satchel Paige. Can you just talk for a moment about some of the issues and questions that begin to be unlocked when we consider a figure like Satchel Paige in the company of some of these other athletes who were a part of, shall we say, mainstream professional baseball?
Well, Satchel is, in a sense, and again, we're back to all these guys had something to overcome, right? And I think some of the time it's apparent. Sometimes it's just mechanics, or sometimes it's just, oh, I've got to somehow control my fastball better, you know, which is kind of what Nolan Ryan went through. Maybe there's something even from a medicine standpoint. Maybe there's some kind of injury they have to overcome. In Satchel Paige's case, it was pretty much trying to have himself known. In a sense, he existed for so long. He pitched in his prime before the color barrier was broken in 1947 by Jackie Robinson. So even though he had a name out there, he wasn't known by the mainstream media. He wasn't known really by the mainstream baseball fan. And I think a large part of his career is trying to battle through that and to get out of this netherworld, this shadow land, and actually be recognized as a great athlete. You know, Satchel didn't really break into the major leagues till his 40s and pitched after that. By that point, his fastball certainly wasn't as great as it was in his 20s and 30s. And yet, you know, I think even then you saw glimmers of what Satchel Paige was, and I think there was a growing respect for the incredible pitcher and fireballer that he was. And in a sense, it's funny, Paige pitching in the majors then allows us to work backwards a little bit and maybe gives credence to this whole era of baseball and the Negro Leagues that was kind of forgotten. And I think the success of Satchel Paige then had others thinking, well, okay, he was really, really good. And then maybe, okay, let's take another harder look maybe at somebody like Josh Gibson or Cool Papa Bell or Martin Diego and people that were just kind of names and not a lot saw. And it's interesting, that's one of the fun things I find with baseball sometimes is the historical component. You can kind of work back and forth with it. And I think Paige, even though he made the majors late in his career because of the success he had, it allowed people then to kind of look back and realize what a great athlete not only he was, but what a great group of athletes he was playing with and against.
Do you have time for two more questions?
I'm good.
Great.
I'm sorry it's so noisy
no,
here.
But we're doing great. This is fine.
Okay.
This is, as we said kind of at the top of the interview, already a complicated enough question you are wrestling with. Who's the fastest pitcher of all time? And I'm kind of intrigued and impressed by the fact that in your book, you are not afraid to explore what, at least on the surface, might seem like tangents that don't necessarily have a whole lot to do with baseball, which in a sense, on the one hand, seems like it makes it even, you know, a more complicated process of wrestling with this question that's already complicated on its own. And yet, on the other hand, it seems like it's where this sort of wrestling and reflecting takes you. And I'm glad because it's some of the most interesting stuff in the book. I mean, like when you compare throwing a fastball with writing a paragraph, I mean, compare those things side by side. Tell us how those passages in the book ultimately got there. I mean, by what process do we find those kind of intriguing moments in the book?
I think we find it very, because I was wrestling a lot in doing this book. You know, you point out the one section where I compare, in a sense, how you set up a hitter, you know, alternating speeds, even pitches with writing a quality paragraph or good writing. I teach writing at Johns Hopkins, and that's something I grapple with quite a bit with my own work, but also with my students. You know, I'll look at something maybe they've done, and I know how hard they've worked, and they've talked to maybe a fair amount of people, they've done their research, and yet maybe this paragraph or this page doesn't work all that well. And I'm trying at times in a very almost pragmatic way to try to give them some feedback and some weapons to say, okay, this isn't reading well, but maybe here's why. And I think when you're talking music, when you're talking writing, when you're talking, almost anything.
Engineering in the art, or...
yeah, there's an alchemy involved, you know? I mean, very, very good performances, very, very good writing. It's the sum is greater than the parts. And at times, I think that's what we're all kind of searching for if we're in those type of areas, is trying to go, okay, that's somehow head and shoulders above everything, and that's really working well. Why? And sometimes you take it apart and you get a good idea. Other times, not necessarily. And I think some of almost all the fireballers in high heat, there's an alchemy involved. They know when they are, you know, really pitching well, when they were on their game, then somehow they had tapped into something that I think is, you know, very similar to maybe what a great composer taps into, what a great writer taps into. It's very difficult to explain, but, you know, some athletes call it being in the zone, whatever it may be, but somehow you're in that rarefied air where your efforts suddenly are taking on a new dimension. And frankly, I think that's one thing that kept them going. And in an odd way, maybe that's what keeps me going with my writing and my teaching. And I know in talking with, you know, other, you know, people, artists, musicians and such, I mean, those are the days you live for. You know, suddenly you're, you know, things connect and you're doing things faster, better, deeper than you ever did before.
That state, which is sometimes called the state of flow.
That's right. That's very much state of flow. Yes.
So ultimately, you do not shy away from amassing a list of the greats, the top 12, and ultimately even are not averse to sort of stepping out on a limb and kind of filling in the blank.
Well, I felt like I had to by the end of this thing. So
I'm sorry?
I felt like I had to. So,
well,
you know.
that's actually exactly my question. I mean, did you... Were you seriously tempted to, in a sense, answer this question with "there is no answer," or not?
I was seriously tempted, but I felt I'd gone this far. I had to take a crack, and in a sense, okay, here is my top 12, and people, you know, some have disagreed with it, some folks have agreed, but you know, it certainly becomes a talking thing, talking point, but. One of the things I found interesting is, Greg, as I interviewed, good God, I think, you know, well over 70, 80 people for the book. And my last question almost to all of them was, okay, give me at least your top half dozen fireballers, best ones of all time, 1 to 6. And if you want to go deeper, I'm listening. Well, we can go as deep as you want to go. And I was always struck by the initial reaction of most folks, and we're talking scouts, coaches, hitters, other fireball pitchers, et cetera, you know, historians, their first reaction often was, oh, no, you can't do that. You're comparing eras and, you know, this is too tough and, you know, in a sense, kind of all the regular excuses cropped up. And I knew the excuses well because they were cropping up in my own head, too. But then almost invariably, there'd be this pause, and then they would go, okay, Walter Johnson, Sandy Koufax, Nolan Ryan, you know, in a sense, they would give me their rundown. Hmm. And that got me to thinking, well, I'm going to have to give my rundown, my list of all-time greats, too, at some point. And a lot of it, obviously, was impacted by what other people had said, what other people, the arguments others made, you know, for some fireballers over others. You know, one of the great questions in there is, you know, we've touched on him briefly, the Steve Wilkowski pitcher who arguably, you know, we know he pitched about 107 miles per hour at one point. But Steve Wilkowski, you know, the character that the Bull Durham pitcher was based on, never made the major leagues. And so, therefore, even guys that had been with Steve Wilkowski in the minors, even Earl Weaver, his former manager in the minors, who went on to become a great manager with the Baltimore Orioles, even they would pause and say, I don't know if I can quite name him the number one guy because he never made the major leagues. And so almost all these fireballers, there's some hook, there's some little criteria and kind of how you answer some of these basic questions kind of determines where you fall in on it.
Well, it's a good thing because that helps this to be such an interesting book, doesn't it?
Yeah.
If all of this were a tidy matter, you wouldn't have had much to do, and instead there's all kinds of things for you to write about and explore.
Yeah, and that ended up being an awful lot of fun. Once you got back the angst and, you know, gnashing your teeth, like, how far have I really painted myself back into a corner?
The book is called High Heat, The Secret History of the Fastball and the Improbable Search for the Fastest Pitcher of All Time. It's published by Da Capo. It's author Tim Wendel. Tim Wendel, this is one of the most entertaining, thought-provoking, creative books about baseball I've read in a long, long time, and I enjoyed it so much, and this opportunity to speak with you about it on The Morning Show. Thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.